dark and open and exciting chambers of the Senate Education and General Government Committee, Hearing Room A at the Capitol. Thank you very much. My rule still stands, even though we're in a special supplemental session. If you have a cell phone or anything that beeps, turn it off, please. Otherwise, you'll be contributing to the Common School Fund. That's how we fund education in Oregon, you know. So we do that as a matter of courtesy to make sure you don't interrupt someone's testimony. Because it's scary enough for people to testify if you're not a regular participant in the process. We are going to take these bills. Let me tell you what order. I think they're in the order that they are on the agenda. Dana? Ms. Richardson?
Madam Chair, they are not.
Okay.
Would you like to just briefly do the committee rules?
Well, we'll do that in a sec,
okay.
But I just want people to know. Shoot. I think that's my cell phone. Woohoo!
Do as I say, not as I do.
You didn't hear it. It started to vibrate, and I got it. Oh, man.
I didn't hear a thing, Madam Chair.
Is my face all red? Sufficiently so.
Pay for the -4 amendments on 1056.
I think so. Okay, I just want to tell people what order, and then you can go play out in the hallway if you don't want to hang around just right away. So we are going to start out with, after we do our rules and stuff, we'll go into Senate Bill 1099. But before that, we're going to hear from Representative Gillum on Senate Bill 1059, because he has another commitment, and we'll close the hearing and come back to that. So we'll hear quickly from Representative Gillum, then we'll do 1099, then 1066, and then 1067 and 1059. So that will be last up again on the agenda, and we will adjourn about 5:30. So if you have other things you want to go do, there's not a lot of places to hide in the Capitol right now. You can go do that. So with that, we have rules that are, you've all seen, they're standard in every committee this session. Unless you have an issue, I'll take a motion.
You can open an organizational.
After I open the organizational meeting, and that's why I have such a good vice chair. Okay. You're keeping
me on the toes.
Madam
Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules for the 2008 special session.
Thank you. Senator Cruz
or
moves.
Or supplemental session, which is what Peter would prefer. So.
Yeah. We'll put the two words together, the special supplemental session. So any objection from anyone? Hearing none? So ordered. Okay. Committee members, just to let everybody know, I'll just have you briefly go down, introduce yourself, and just say where you're from.
Frank Morris from District 8, which is Corvallis, Albany, and general area surrounding parts of Lynn and Benton County.
Rick Metzger, District 26, from Welch's, which is basically the Mount Hood Loop.
With lots of snow right now.
Lots of snow.
Good. Ms. Richardson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee administrator for this fine committee, and if anyone's interested, House Education and House Government Accountability and Information Technology.
Yeah, so if you need Dana, she's right here. Okay.
Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Coos, and Curry counties, part or all of the above, and have been your kind of right-hand person for
several...
Left-hand person.
You're a lefty. Lefty liberal.
Yeah. To be to the left of Senator Walker is a dubious honor.
hard to achieve, too.
Yeah, it is. We've been together for several years on this committee now, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And our newest member.
Not the newest anymore.
Well, on this committee.
One of the newest.
On this committee, however.
Mark Hass, Washington County and Southwest Portland.
All right, great. It's a pleasure to have you all back and ready to do some work, because we've got the most bills of any other committee, because they know we can get the work done. And I want to introduce Beth Herzog, who is our assistant. So thank you very much. With that, we will close the organizational meeting, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1059. Ms. Richardson, you want to talk about that while Representative Gillum comes forward?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1059. Let's see. Thank you, Senator. Require school district contracts for admission of non-resident pupils to specify school districts transferring pupils out of district to agree to accept an equal number of students from the receiving district, and the districts accepting the pupils agree to release an equal number of students to the sending district. This applies to contracts entered into after the effective date of the Act. It declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Great. Thank you. Representative Gilliam, you need to identify yourself, and you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vic Gilliam, House District 18, Silverton and Malala, and I thank you for letting me just say a quick few words about 1059. You'll get more detailed and expert testimony, I think, after a little while. I have a great deal of respect for this side of the body, and I highly recommend your new senator, Fred Girard. In my first session, the original session of 07, I sought the counsel of Roger Beyer many, many times, and Roger Beyer never, ever sought my counsel.
Maybe that's why he's not here anymore.
Thank you, Matt.
That was a softball. I just had to give it back to you.
We're going to get along fine. But I have a great deal of respect for him, and I became aware of this bill, but certainly not proficient in it in the last session. And so here we are in this, I don't certainly want to be incendiary, special supplemental, are we okay with that,
mm-hmm.
session. And it's sort of falls on me to make a comment about this because the issue that sort of the spotlight or the impetus for this bill is in my district. So I'm just here to say this. I have two great districts, school districts. Actually, I have three districts in my district, and my kids are in one of them, Silver Falls, and we've had an excellent experience. The other district that you'll hear from is Malala River. And Malala River is another great school district on the rise academically, and they have a lot to be proud of. So we have two great districts, and more importantly, we have two great leaders. I have relied on their counsel in trying to sort through all the issues that we have regarding education. So I'm happy to report to you that through discussions in the last few days and as late as today, that I believe that the issue that motivates this bill can be resolved at the local level without your action. So I would urge you to keep that in mind when you hear the testimony. I've talked with the chair, and I know there are other issues in other districts around the state that you may want to relate or talk about. But as far as Silver Falls and Malala River, I believe we can resolve this. And I want to make the point that I believe if there's ever a local control issue, if at all possible, to keep it the local level, this is one of them. As is anything, when we begin to delve into it, the issues get a little bit complicated, but it has to do with circumstances and economy and a lot of situations that we here cannot know the detail of. And I'm confident that with the attitude that has been displayed by both my superintendents, Craig Rossler at Silver Falls that you'll hear from and Wayne Costner at Malala River, that in our case, we can resolve this. And I will say this. I think that Senator Beyer had a good reason to be concerned. And to the extent that bringing it to your committee pushes people towards solutions, then I think it has been a good one. But I believe we can resolve it. I think that that if we don't, then I think I'll be the first one, Lord willing and the creek don't rise, that I come back in 09 to address it from a legislative standpoint. But I'm here to say I'm encouraged, and I think you will enjoy the testimony from my two supers. And that would conclude my comments unless you had any questions.
Well, I actually do. I mean, I know the background of this representative, but I don't think the committee does. So could you just really tell us why we're here? I mean, you don't have to name names if you don't want. Just say what the issue is so that my committee understands what the issue is.
I think the issue is generally this, finding equity in the transfer of students between districts.
There you go.
And that can be a difficult thing because it seems very simple to say five in from yours, five out from mine. But it gets more complicated than that. Malala River, as you will hear a little later, is in the middle of a policy review on this. But because of their situation and geography in our state, they've got different situations with Silver Falls, with Canby, with Jervis. So that's the issue, is figuring out what's equitable for families and students in the transfer between districts. Is that a good summary?
That's a good summary. So we're here because there have been some concerns that the equity, the transfer of students, has not been equitable between the two districts, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And there has been, and between them, there have been ongoing transfers of students that have worked out very well.
Right.
But the overall number is difficult to sometimes to hammer out because, okay, for one, it seems in one particular year it seems unfair and vice versa.
Okay. And you're right. It's probably a local issue, but we've had those local issues come here before. We had Canyonville School District come here last session, and we're still not done resolving that. But we did help give them a little push in the right direction. So, okay, are there any questions from the committee? We'll come back to this bill a little bit later. Okay, Representative, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will recess the hearing on Senate Bill 1059, and we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 1099. And Ms. Richardson, what's going on there?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1099 establishes the Committee on Performance Excellence. It defines the committee mission and performance-focused areas. It directs the committee to recommend Legislative Assembly approval of grants for continuous improvement projects. It requires the committee to make periodic public reports on achievement of performance excellence, declares an emergency as an effective upon passage. It currently has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I have a fiscal impact statement that I believe you do not currently have, okay, so I will distribute that as we move along talking about this. There are also two amendments on this bill. Would you like me to talk about those,
mm-hmm,
provided I didn't just cut away the paper that explains what they do?
Okay.
Dash twos. Honestly, I haven't even looked at it. I just got them before we walked in.
Okay.
But I can tell you what they're supposed to do. Let's start with the dash ones. It requires agencies audited by the Secretary of State to identify audit recommendations that present an opportunity for continuous improvement. It requires a report on such recommendations to the committee within 3 months of the date the audit report is issued. It requires an agency plan for addressing the recommendations to be submitted to the committee within 6 months from the date the audit report is issued. It requires the Secretary to supply the committee with audit reports made by or for the Division of Audits. The dash twos would add two committee members to the committee. This was a recommendation from SEIU or a request from SEIU. And Tommy, do you have the 1099-2s?
I have dash one.
That's all I have, too.
Why don't I just...
We will get that circulated. And, colleagues, this is going to be, we're going to have a lot of situations like this where we're going to get the amendment right as we go into committee. So I hope you're patient with us. I think Senator Morse will probably want to talk to us in more detail about one and two as well as the bill. And, Ms. Richardson, this bill is basically a do-over of Senate Bill 1039 from the last session, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And the last one was unceremoniously vetoed by the governor. And so we did hear this issue in our committee in the interim, said about Senator Morse to find resolution with the center office, and I think you've done that. So do you want to step down and testify with those from the governor's office? We've got Kelly Skye and George Notton from BAM, if you're here. You want to just come and testify with Senator Morse? Since I think he had to get sign-off from both of you. Oh, and here's the fiscal. I'm going to distribute that.
On this bill.
Oh, that's not too much money. Okay, I'll let Senator Morse lead off, if you don't mind.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Frank Morse, Senator from District 8. You'll recall Senate Bill 1039 from the previous session. The bill had wide-ranging support. It had unanimous approval in the Senate, and it had only one dissenting vote in the House. And the governor vetoed the bill, and I'll let the governor's staff address those reasons. But I would suggest to you that in hindsight, the governor's veto was appropriate.
Oh.
Because I do believe we have brought forward a better measure for your consideration. I would like to read the whereases, and while these do not go into the statute, I think they're important to consider because it puts in context the purpose of this bill. Whereas the state cannot legislate excellence but can expect it, support it, and acknowledge it when it occurs, and whereas excellence is a passion, and when it exists, the Legislative Assembly should support it fully, and whereas innovation involves calculated risk-taking that should be supported when it occurs, and whereas the purpose of this legislation is to create a process that will oversee the journey to excellence and will encourage the most vital aspects of Oregon state government to be managed at a world-class level. That sets the bar very high.
That's poetry, Senator Morris. Did you write that?
Well, I had people that helped.
That's absolute poetry, that last paragraph. I just want to tell you that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But it does set the bar very high. The previous bill vested in the legislature, or representatives from the legislature on this committee, an authority to direct. This bill is, while the intent of that bill was collaborative, the language was more directive. This bill is truly on a collaborative basis. And I know that we as members, we tend to want to twist the knobs. And when, particularly having served on Ways and Means and listening to agency presentations, you'd like to actually manage, you know, and influence the management of that agency. It's beyond our purview to do that. Wherein we can provide the resources to help and be collaborative in that process with the expectation, again, by this, the expectation is that we want greater accountability, we want greater performance, and we want excellence, and the public expects it and demands it. So the issue is, how do you create that process where the legislature and the executive branch can move together and accomplish high-performing organizations, agencies within state government. And I think this bill sets us in that direction. I would like to compliment the governor's office, legislative fiscal, with BAM and DAS. We did work and create language that we're presenting to you today that does have acceptance, I believe, from all quarters. I would like to speak specifically to the amendments that are being offered, the -1s and the -2s. Our colleagues in the House have reviewed this bill. They're hearing it essentially the same bill tomorrow. And they have offered up these amendments that I think are very appropriate, because when the Secretary of State does audit reviews, whether they be performance or whether they be financial, that they're in those audits undoubtedly many times are created opportunities for improvement. And so this closes the loop. It brings the Secretary of State into the process by submitting those reports to the committee. Then the agency that's under the audit review would then submit within 3 months the concepts they have identified out of that audit for continuous improvement, and then in 6 months identify a specific plan. The other thing that this bill does that the previous bill did not do is that we did, in fact, allocate in our budget $2.5 million specifically for continuous improvements, performance enhancements, efficiency-type efforts to support the executive branch where they identify these opportunities for improvement. And so this committee then becomes the focal point to review, advise, and assist and target those, you know, the best returns that we could expect and recommend to the emergency board that those funds then, in fact, be distributed for that purpose. So, Madam Chair, colleagues, I think we have a better bill. And I'm pleased to sit at the table here today with the executive branch and know that we're on the same page.
Great. Thank you, Senator Morris. And then the -2 amendment.
Oh, excuse me, the -2. Yes, and it was unfortunately an oversight in not including this. As I had commented to some folks in the hallway that represent frontline employees earlier this afternoon, In my business experience, I have come to the conclusion that you cannot achieve world-class performance. You cannot achieve a high-performing status unless you engage frontline employees. Mm-hmm. We call them team members in my company, and truly they were. That it takes that input from the front line to achieve and move an organization in the right direction. And so we have included in this committee one member from the largest employee representative unit and one member from a representable employees not represented by the employee represented unit in subparagraph A, which means big and then smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's good. It's a good addition. I would recommend both of these amendments, the dash ones and the dash twos, for your consideration.
Thank you. And I agree with that. That was an oversight on my part, too. I remember when I signed on to the bill as your co-chief sponsor, I was just handed the bill. I was in committee, and I signed it. But I'm so glad others had looked at that, because I agree with you. The frontline workers are really the ones from where we actually learn how we're doing things wrong and how we could do them better. Because they carry out the directions of the supervisory staff, and you know they know how to do it better. So thank you for that. Any questions of Senator Morrison? We'll hear from
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Morris, just want to make sure I understand language here, and I'm speaking specifically to the dash one. And because the Secretary of State will audit an agency and they will identify deficiencies. And then it's incumbent upon the agency to address those deficiencies. We have called them opportunities for continuous improvement, but we are still talking about the same thing. Is that correct? We're just using nicer words. Well, it's an art here, and I understand that. And what I don't want to happen is there's not a report. There's deficiencies in operation, and because we have called it something else, it allows the agency to pick and choose, and which I don't think is what we intended. So I'm just kind of for the record making sure that we are using different words and talking about the same thing.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think you're absolutely correct. An audit does not necessarily point out deficiencies. It quite often points out compliance.
Right.
And wherein there are deficiencies, those should translate into opportunities for improvement. Mm-hmm. And that's the intent of this amendment.
Madam Chair, I fully agree with that. I just wanted to be on the record that it's kind of we're doing some wordsmithing here and we're putting it in a more positive light, and I appreciate that. But make sure that we all are well aware of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. All right. Ms. Guy, you want to tell us the governor really loves this bill now?
Yes, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Skye, and I am Governor Kulongoski's general counsel, and I am here today to convey the governor's support for Senate Bill 1099 and also to convey his appreciation to the sponsors of the bill, to members of the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Budget and Management Office, and specifically to Senator Morse for their hard work together to craft this bill, which I will fully agree with Senator Morse is a better bill than the bill that was before the legislature last session. And it's better because it is collaborative and because it takes into account the processes that were already in place through budget and management and allows budget and management to work with the Legislative Fiscal Office and the committee so that it's a collaborative process. So Senator Morse was gracious enough to reach out to us and to help us work through the governor's concerns with the previous form of this bill. And this bill accomplishes that, respecting the separate and equal roles of the two branches of government that are involved and bringing them together in a collaborative process. So the governor joins the legislature in their demand for performance excellence and is actually quite pleased to have this opportunity to partner in this endeavor. And as to the amendments, we have no problem with either of those amendments. In fact, I think the governor had at one point suggested that the Secretary of State's office was a good place to start because they are already performing this auditing function. And on the dash twos, we have no problem with those either.
Okay, great. Mr. Naughton.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm George Naughton, the administrator of the Budget and Management Division. I've provided written testimony for you. I'm not going to read all of that. I just wanted to highlight a couple things for you. Again, this is a joint project with both Budget and Management Division and Legislative Fiscal Office working together to staff this committee. We do think that this is a great opportunity for both the offices to work with the members of this committee, and look at ways to improve performance and really facilitate the things the agencies are doing. There are a lot of good efforts going on there right now with agencies to do improvement efforts. Department of Human Services is undergoing a very large one right at the moment. It's good to have these conversations and where we find those opportunities to really highlight them and showcase them and provide them the support to make them successful, and quite frankly to encourage other of those activities to start as well. So we think this is a great opportunity.
Oh, we're just singing our praises. Aren't you glad I didn't agree to help you run a veto?
Absolutely.
We were going to do a veto override. Well, yes.
It would have been fun.
Yes. And I said, you know, let's try to work with the governor's office. I think we might get farther along, and we have. And Senator Morse, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate the time that you put into making this bill something we can all be proud of. I'm just very pleased. You should be very proud of your work.
Well, Madam Chair, it's very much a collaborative effort.
Yeah.
And that's really what works.
Yeah,
In the final analysis, and that's what gets things done.
We did have Ken Rocco from Legislative Fiscal Office here, but he's staffing the Ways and Means Committee right now, so he just needed to know if we had any questions. We did not, so I sent him on his way. But it's nice to know that it's a collaborative effort as well between your two agencies. Okay, well, any other questions of this panel? If not, we have just a couple more people. Thank you very much. I have Megan Moyer from SEIU.
For the record, I'm Megan Moyer with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. Chair Walker, members of the committee, I am testifying today in favor of 1099, and I really just want to thank the chair and Senator Morse for listening to our concerns and being so flexible on such a short timeline and in drafting Amendment 2. Which was our hope in the inclusion of frontline workers in this important process toward excellence. And I think it's been great to hear the support and the understanding of this committee of the importance of the perspective of the people working day-to-day implementing the public services of the state of Oregon. And I really appreciate your accommodation in addressing this issue and valuing their insight and their participation in this important process.
You're more than welcome, and I'm glad we could facilitate that so quickly. I want to thank Legislative Council for getting that to us in just a matter of a couple of hours. So that was terrific. Any questions from the committee? All right. Thank you, Megan. I just want to hear from Mr. Hibner. He's in the audience. Mr. Hibner is director of the Audits Division, and I just...
This may screw up the whole thing.
Wouldn't have been the first time.
We've got your blessing here, but remember, you have to identify yourself.
I'm Chuck Hibner, director of the Audits Division. Madam Chair, as a member of the committee, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. We have no problems with the underlying bill. I think it's probably a good idea, and then the amendments we have no problem with. So.
Oh, that's great. That's all I wanted to hear and get that on the record. You're all prepared to... So watch this go into action.
You bet. Anything we can do to improve the readership of our audit reports, which the men...
Oh, that's a perfect line.
That is a good one.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Hibner. Thanks for coming down. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1099 and open a work session. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1099.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1099. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 1099.
And Senator Cruz moves the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 1099. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1099 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Oh, now I got to read that one because you had a cheat sheet too. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1099 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Let's call the roll, Judge. questions.
Yeah, we will, because this is great. All right, again, I just want to thank you, Senator Morse, and if we have no discussion, I'm going to have the roll call, because this is just a really nice occasion to do so.
Senator Hatt?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
All right. Senate Bill 1099 passes on its way to Ways and Means. Senator Morse, I hope when it comes up out of Ways and Means, you have an opportunity to carry it on the floor.
Thank you.
All right. So we will have you go over and tell the House we've already taken care of your bill from last session.
They're still organizing.
Yeah. All right. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 1099. Thank you very much. Let me just get my stuff together here and make sure it gets in the right bill file I've got. Okay, this one is for you. And you might want to write Mr. Hibner's name down there. Okay, so now we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1066. And Ms. Richardson, if you want to tell us about that, and we'll have President Courtney come on up and speak. I think I saw him come in the room.
Madam Chair, there are 3 to 5 parts of Senate Bill 1066. So I think what I'll do now is talk about the portion that President Courtney is here to testify
mm-hmm.
on. And that portion of the bill charges school districts with developing an education program to prevent the use of anabolic steroids and performance enhancing supplements. He would also be speaking to the -3 amendments, which clarifies the provisions relating to the education on anabolic steroids and performance-enhancing supplements.
Okay, great. This bill has 3 parts. It's kind of it's relating to education bill. So we're going to have a little fun with it and see what we can put in it. And this is one of our leftover bills. Yeah, Senator... Mr. President, you didn't know that was going to happen, did you?
No, I didn't know
that
was going to happen.
It'll be okay here.
It'll be all right. We'll be just fine. So this comes back to us from the last session. We worked so hard on this bill for you, and we encountered some additional problems. So you want to tell us what we're trying to fix?
I'm Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive, Northeast, here in Salem, 97303. I'm a state senator, District 11. Parts of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. I'm here today to talk about the amendment to Senate Bill 1066. I was before the committee during the interim a few weeks ago when we talked about the amendment, and so we're introducing the amendment today, and I believe all parties are going to reach an agreement on this. It clarifies Senate Bill 517, which, as you said, Chair Walker, what you worked hard on. I know Senator Cruz worked very hard on last session, among others. Clarifies that the school districts, and not the Department of Education is responsible for developing the curricula around these issues of, you know, the steroid use and performance-enhancing drugs. That was one of the big concerns that we dealt with during the interim. Still requires anabolic steroids and performance-enhancing drug education for all children grades K through 12. So we're still going to talk about it for all the grades. You might recall in the interim there was concern, well, maybe just make it apply to high school. And the bill itself went from K through 12. We're going to keep that. Again, it's going to be the school districts that set up the program. Also requires use of evidence-based programs such as the Atlas program and the Athena program, developed by the Oregon Health Science University for reducing use of performance-enhancing substances by high school athletes, extends the deadlines for these changes and curricular developments to 2008-2009 school year. So that's the amendment that I was asked to see if we agreed to. We worked hard on that. We have representatives here from the Department of Education. I don't know if representatives are here from Oregon Health Science University. It's my understanding that they're in agreement with the amendment, Chair Walker.
Okay. Thank you. Does any member of the committee have any question of President Courtney? Okay. Great. Morgan, do you want to say anything?
For the record, Morgan Allen, Department of Education. No, we are pleased with the amendment, and we appreciate Senator Courtney and his staff working with us, and the researchers and scientists at OHSU gave us some good input and helped us craft this amendment to make it more appropriate for our students. So, thank you.
Okay, great. Any questions? That was painless.
Thank you,
Mr. President. So that's the -3 amendment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
Was there anyone else here? There's people signed up to testify on other things on the bill, but is there anyone here to testify on that aspect of the bill? Okay, great. I didn't think so. Then we will move on to the next section of the bill, Ms. Richardson, which is?
Madam Chair, let's talk about the OEBB next. Does that meet
that
your...
That sounds great.
This bill clarifies the dates when represented and non-represented employees of school districts participate in the school district benefit plans that was adopted in forming the OEBB last session.
Okay, and I have Denise Hall here to speak about that. Is there anyone else here to speak about that issue? Okay, Denise, come on up. We've heard this issue before. Mm-hmm. I don't think anything has changed since the interim.
Short and sweet. Good afternoon, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Denise Hall. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. I'm here before you today on behalf of the Benefits Board to support Section 7 of Senate Bill 1066, which clarifies the phase-in requirements for districts into the new benefits program. The Benefits Board was created by passage of Senate Bill 426 during the 2007 session, and the board is charged with designing and implementing a benefits program for school and education service districts. The amendments in Senate Bill 1066 actually support the board's commitment to limiting the administrative issues that a school district may go through during the phase-in of these plans. It also ensures that the participation levels anticipated during the original legislation should be accomplished during the 2008, 2009, and 2010 plan year. They provide that mandated movement to the plans available through the OEB is based on the specific collective bargaining agreement for employee groups rather than the district as a whole, and it also allows the non-represented employee groups to be treated consistently with those who are represented by collective bargaining agreements. I appreciate your time today, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Okay, and Ms. Hall, are you moving right along on getting everything ready to go?
We are moving along. We have
a very short time frame
out, and we expect the plan proposals to be in by the mid-February. Mm-hmm. So we have everything in place to have plans available on October 1st, 2008.
Okay, great. And I didn't check, but does this go into effect? Do we have any clause on this bill? So this goes into effect right away. Okay, so you can proceed.
There is
okay.
Clause.
All right. Any other questions or any questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Hall. Okay. Great. All right. Next issue, Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, the third item within Senate Bill 1066 deals with TAG funding. It specifies that up to $350,000 from the state school fund may be spent for the administration of the TAG education program. It removes the limit on the percentage of amount of appropriated monies that the department may use for administration of TAG education. It permits such funds to be used for services, including contracting for creation and administration of regional TAG centers.
Okay. And I've got Morgan Allen to come talk about that. And I think Sue Love, were you here to talk about that as well? Hi, Sue. Come on up. And I believe that's all I have signed up on this issue. If I'm wrong, raise your hand. Okay.
Chair Walker, again for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. I'll keep our remarks brief. The genesis of this legislation came out of Senate Bill 622, which Senator Metzger sponsored, which passed out of this committee and did not make it through the Ways and Means process. And at the end of the session, there was an appropriation for $350,000 off the top of the state school fund given to the department to expend on TAG programs. Unfortunately, none of the TAG supporters or legislators of the department had an opportunity to see that amendment before it was included in the bill. And there was a conflict, as Mr. Richardson pointed out, that prohibited us from spending the money as was envisioned in Senate Bill 622. And our intention is to, with the funds available, the $350,000, to increase our TAG staff person, which is currently a 0.3 FTE, to make that a full-time 1.0 FTE within the department, and use any remaining funds to contract for regional talented and gifted centers at some of Oregon's colleges and universities. So we're supportive of the amendment and appreciate the opportunity to get that clarification.
Okay. And Ms. Lowe?
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Walker and members of the Education Committee. For the record, my name is Sue Love, and I'm a resident of Salem, and I am the current secretary for the Oregon Association of Talented and Gifted. And I just came here today to say thank you to the members of the committee for the work that you have begun during this past session for Oregon's 41,000-plus identified talented and gifted students. And in addition, I would like to extend a very special thank you to Senator Metzger and Becca Feathers, who worked tirelessly during this previous session on behalf of these students. And OTAG and myself, our family, is looking forward to what future sessions will bring for this population of students. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Love. And I'm sorry we didn't get it right the first time, but sometimes that happens.
That's okay. I wish my son wanted to be here, but he's works in the library after school.
We've seen him before. He's very industrious. Yeah. Senator Metzger.
Well, just an observation, and I think Chair Walker, you made this earlier in this interim, is just kind of a reminder as we move towards 2009, and I know a number of you have served on the Ways and Means of May next time, is why it's really important, why we have policy committees that send things to Ways and Means when our friends who think they're being helpful say, well, I don't need the bill, I just give you the money, and that happens often, and you've made that comment. There's a reason why you spend all the time writing the policy to direct how the money is used, because otherwise we have to come back and clean things up. And I know sometimes in the end of session there's this thing with, well, we got so many bills, let's just allocate the money and forget the bills. And there's a reason why these committees worked those bills and directed monies in an appropriate way to avoid these kinds of problems. And hopefully next session in the Ways and Means process will recognize the value of the language as well as the dollars that support the programs that the committees do.
It would be a first.
It would be a first, but it would be a gold star first that we would love to see. Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you both very much. Okay, that was our third issue. We've got a fourth one now. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, the -1 amendments repeal the statute on the first aid cards required for teaching licenses.
Ah, Ms. Chamberlain, alive and well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, the director of the Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And the -1 amendments are very brief. They would repeal ORS 342-126, an issue I brought before the interim committee. It's a statute that requires the commission to suspend the license of teachers who have not obtained a first aid card within 90 days. As I explained to the interim committee, it really has been fairly dysfunctional for nearly 20 years. And as we were going through and reviewing our statutes, we realized that we either needed to have the legislature tell us if you wanted us to continue to do this, and then we would get going on it, or help us out by repealing it. But I would just really quickly point out to you that also in statute is a requirement that districts keep a certain percentage of their staff under the Department of Education rules holding first aid cards. And I gave you that rule here in my testimony on page 3. And it just basically says for every 60 students that the district shall have at least one staff member. And it does not say a licensed staff member. And it doesn't say a licensed staff member in the statute either. So these statutes are almost a little bit in conflict. So the commission is here to support, hopefully with your support, the repeal of the statute to sort of clean it up.
Yeah, I think we're quite happy to do that. Any other questions or comments?
No.
Good. Well, thank you, and I appreciate that you made the effort to come over today. I think we're going to get this one moving.
Thank you.
Okay, and then I think we've got one other issue in this bill.
Madam Chair, the -2 and the -4 amendments are related. If you do not have the -4 amendments, please let me know. The -2 amendments require a waiver of tuition and mandatory fees for a child spouse or unremarried surviving spouse of a service member under certain circumstances. It permits the Department of Veterans Affairs to contract with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to disperse tuition waiver amendments. The -4 amendments carry that language forward. However, they are designed to clarify with regard to determining the disability of a veteran, the 100% disability criteria, that the federal Department of Veterans Affairs would make that determination, not the state Department of Veterans Affairs, as you would see in the -2 amendments.
So the dash 4 replaces the dash 2.
It does.
Okay, so draw a line through that one. Okay, so this colleague, this came to me because Mr. Thornhill, who's here to testify today, was looking to introduce a bill for the 08 session, and when I got his email, it was way past the time for us to have introduced a bill, so I suggested we try to run it as an amendment to a relating to education bill, and this is the only one we have. So I'll have Mr. Thornhill come up, if he would, and testify about what he's trying to do. And thank you, all you other gentlemen, for coming and offering your support. I appreciate it. Mr. Thornhill, did you want anyone else to testify with you? Okay. Got it.
Got a lot of support right behind me, though.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, Senators, my name is Robert Thornhill. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I appear before you as a member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Post 1442 in Portland, and as the Veterans of Foreign Wars Action Officer on a project to obtain legislation authorizing a waiver of tuition and fees for orphans and widows of deceased veterans and of veterans 100% disabled. I appear in support of Senate Bill 1066-2 Amendment, or perhaps Dash 4 now, but anyway, the waiver amendment. With your permission, I've submitted written testimony. I will summarize my testimony. For sake of brevity and ease of expression in my summary, I will use the male pronoun, but please understand this in no way meant to diminish the important role of women in today's armed forces. The waiver program that we espouse applies to female as well as male soldiers. Also, I shall use the generic term soldier to cover all branches of the armed forces, to include Marines. And I say this for the benefit of the Marines backing me up here today.
Wise thing to do that.
Without question, those who wait also serve. And those who wait, but whose soldier comes home in a body bag, are severely disabled, next to the soldier himself, give more and sacrifice more than anyone else for the liberties we enjoy in America. President Lincoln laid out the issue well when he said in his second inaugural speech that we, the people of the United States, must care for him who has borne the battle and for his widow and orphan. The waiver program is a further, much-needed step, in our opinion, toward fulfilling the obligation to orphans and widows set down by President Lincoln, as well as our obligation to the 100% disabled and unemployable veteran. The waiver program is, in essence, not a giveaway program, but an investment in the college-level education of the fallen soldiers, orphan, and widow, and in the education of the spouse and the children of the 100% disabled. A college education may not be a must to make it in the American economy today, but no one can deny that a college education certainly helps not only the individual, but the nation as a whole. Hillary Clinton wrote a widely read book titled something like It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. I don't know about that, but I do know that in a so-called middle-class family today, it takes two wage earners to raise and pay for the college education of the family's children. In the families involved in this issue, one of the wage earners is absent in one situation, and in the other, he is unemployable. An article in the Sunday, 13 January 2008 edition of the Oregonian estimate that it takes over $17,000 for 1 year of undergraduate study at the University of Oregon. $6,000 of that is for tuition and fees. Thus, even with a waiver, the intended waiver recipients must still come up with a sizable chunk of change. The issue of cost to the taxpayer of the waiver, of course, must be considered. As I detail in my written testimony, from the VFW perspective, the cost is so negligible that it cannot be quantified. First, there is no disbursement of funds to the student. Second, there is no cost to the institution for an extra student in a course already scheduled for conduct and which would be conducted whether or not that extra student attended. Some would say, but the education system is losing the tuition fees the waiver student would otherwise pay. Such an argument must be based on the premise that the waiver student would be in the course even without the waiver. We say that that premise is invalid. I believe it is indisputable that the vast majority of the soldiers fighting and dying in the war on terrorism are not from the upper economic stratum. Indeed, many soldiers enlisted to obtain a college education via the GI Bill, an education they could not otherwise afford. To assume now that the orphan of such a soldier will be able to attend college on his own without the help of the waiver and without the help of one wage-earning parent is believed to be unreasonable. As we see it, there will never, ever be a requirement to conduct a course solely to satisfy the need of a waiver student. As we envision, waiver students will always be that one or extra two students in a course already scheduled and being conducted independently of the student. As indicated by paragraph 2, page 1B of Senate Bill 1066-2, it establishes a waiver program. It provides for educational institutions to waive, that is, to dispense with, not collect, tuition mandatory fees from eligible students. Thus, we basically and heartily support that part of the amendment. However, we have one reservation. Paragraph 7, the reimbursement and other requirements of paragraph 7 on page 2 of the amendment seems to contradict and, in essence, dismantle the waiver program. The provision of paragraph 7 are viewed, as, in our view, as unnecessary complications, requiring, it seems to us, unnecessary budgeting, accounting, and other paperwork to cover a cost that does not really exist. There is a minuscule cost. It is all Oregon taxpayer money. This is no more, in our view, than generating artificial cost figures and then shifting money from one pocket to another without any apparent logical reason. We no longer then have a waiver program. As indicated in my detailed written testimony, the VFW waiver proposal has been patterned after the waiver programs of other states, namely California, Kentucky, and Washington. Information that we can gather on the Internet about these programs indicate they have no such reimbursement requirements. Their programs are truly waiver programs. I have included in my written testimony documents relative to those programs. So with this reservation about paragraph 7, the VFW fully supports the amendment. We'd like to see the reimbursement requirement removed. However, if for some reason it is determined not to remove the paragraph 7 requirements, we urge passage of Senate Bill 1066-2 or more, whatever, as it is written. Senators, I'm not a hero, but I have been honored by American heroes backing me up here today to speak for them. For them and the other 18,000 members of the Oregon Veterans of Foreign Wars, I request that you make an investment in the highly deserving individual involved and vote in favor of this bill. And would you indulge me for one thing, if it doesn't violate the rules? Could I introduce these heroes?
Please, Mr. Thornhill, please.
First, Bert Key, post commander, out around Sandy, somewhere in that area. Bert last wore uniform of an Army colonel, but he started his career as a young Marine, and I don't think he's recovered yet. Dick Strand, WW2, saw it all, Navy. My boss, post commander 1442, Marion Ellsworth, also Navy, saw the whole thing in WW2 Pacific. Another Marine, you can tell, George Winslow, Vietnam veteran, post adjutant, active in VFW. I speak for these guys. Thank you. I'll try to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And there is a look about a Marine that's a bit different.
They don't look like they know where they are.
I didn't say that. You did.
I happen to be a submariner, not a Marine.
Okay. All right. Any questions from the committee? We've got some folks who are going to testify about provision, that paragraph 7 that you've talked about here. And so we'll find out how people think about it. Okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Thornhill.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And by the way, I thank the committee for the Veterans Preference Bill on the last session, SB 822. Thank you very, very much.
Is that working out all right for you? We did it right the first time. Okay, good.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, let me see here. We've got a little bit of a list here. Let's hear from OSAC and George Pernsteiner with OUS. We've got Dennis Johnson with OSAC and Chancellor Pernsteiner, and then John Wyckoff. We can fit all three of you up here. That'll just cover us just fine right there. Okay, so Mr. Chancellor, do you want to start off?
Well, thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm George Pernsteiner with the Oregon University System, and thank you for the opportunity to testify about this bill. It's very difficult to follow the last speaker. I'm glad he used the word soldier and then found out that three of the members, including himself, in fact, would be sailors, because I was going to worry that my own background was not being appropriately recognized, but I take it that's not true, so thank you. This bill, as you know, the Dash 2 and Dash 4 amendments, and I'm presuming the Dash 4s are an update of the Dash 2, although
they,
I do not know.
They are. So just address yourself to the Dash 4.
To the Dash 4s, okay. The Dash 4 amendments do provide support for the children and spouses of the service members killed since September 11th, or totally disabled, or unemployable. I think those are the three categories. It provides, in one section, tuition waivers. In another section, it talks about grants. And I think that the prior speaker spoke of that distinction. And I think one of the questions before the committee then is whether or not it is the intention that the colleges and universities waive tuition, in which case I would agree that Section 7 need not be there and OSAC need not be involved. Because they administer grant programs, and tuition rate waivers are really forgiveness of tuition by the college or university. If, however, the intent is that grants be provided, then, in fact, OSAC is the correct agency, and a fund source for the grants would have to be identified. And I think that's sort of fundamental question one before the committee. I have a series of technical issues and maybe policy choices that arise to my mind, and I just saw this for the first time this afternoon, so you have to forgive me if some of these things you've already worked through. But I'm putting it in the context of other discussions that we've had over the last few sessions in order to determine what might be the legislative intent for this particular bill. The first is, will the waiver or grant, regardless of how you come out with that decision, be provided to both undergraduate students and to graduate students? The bill is silent on that. Most of our programs are, in terms of waivers, have been for undergraduates, but in fact we do waive graduate tuition, as you know, with regard to graduate assistance and certain other kinds of almost student employees. So the question of what you intend in this particular program would be important. Secondly, for a dependent child, does the waiver or grant end when that child turns 24, which is when federal income tax and, you know, treatment ends? Or will it continue if that child had applied for a waiver prior to the time she or he turned 24?
So if, let me interrupt you then. So if they don't go to school right away after high school and they start their freshman year at age 23, then
right.
You're saying that does it end then, or do we take them all the way through 4 years, which takes them past the age of 24?
That's essentially the question. Yeah.
Okay.
The third, though, relates to that, and that is the intent of the waiver to terminate the waiver upon accomplishment of a degree,
okay,
or just to pay to waive tuition for enrollment regardless of whether a degree has already been earned. And I think that's another distinction that you sort of need to decide how you wanted to approach it.
Okay.
That's particularly true if you're going to include graduate enrollment in this. We have to sort of think through what the implications would be on that. There's also a question on residency. Is the intent that the student be a resident of Oregon for fee-paying purposes, which has a particular meaning under Board of Higher Education rules, or is it going to be based on the status of the now possibly deceased parent? This doesn't apply if you're talking about someone who is disabled or unemployable, because that's really clear in the bill that that person has to live in Oregon. However, with regard to a deceased parent, is it required that the student meet regular Oregon resident requirements, residency requirements? Because the way this is written somewhat differently than the way in which the board rules on residency are written. And so it's just a question of your intent as you go forward.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, and I'm sorry to keep muddying this up with technicalities, but I think going back to what I think Senator Metzger said earlier, you know, if we want to get it right or get it right the first time, so I would like to get these things out so that you can discuss how you want to approach them. And the final one that I had deals with the eligibility for admission, and the proposed language makes a student eligible if she or he meets the academic eligibility requirements of an institution. Does that mean that he or she also needs to be admitted to the institution? That's important because there are certain, we talk mostly about the academic eligibility requirements for undergraduates. I understand that. But we do have other requirements that we impose for admission. And that gets especially true at the graduate level, where you don't have a firm cutoff. So as you look at this, it might be simpler to say that they're also admitted to, and then you clarify that issue so they're admitted to an institution. So those are my questions without any answers. And
I got half a loaf here.
Yeah.
And that's probably because Ms. Zavala was at the dentist today.
She was. Elected
she
to have a root canal
charge.
And let me
That says something.
I could certainly discuss with you the sort of the trade-offs if you wanted, but I thought it more important to get the questions before you so that you could make it clear what your intent mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. As this moves forward.
Okay.
So, if you choose to move this forward, I'm sorry. Madam Chair.
Okay. Yes. Senator Pence.
Thank you. I think those are all very workable technical deals that won't derail this at all. I think we should be a little more specific on whether it's graduates or undergraduates. And I don't know about graduates. We all know people who make a lifelong pursuit of going to graduate school. But on the issue of whether this is a grant or a waiver, which one would work best to make this work the way it's intended?
Chair Walker, Senator Haas, the way that Action Officer Thornhill laid it out, it's a waiver. The way we have done certain other programs, such as the one for public safety dependents, it is a grant. And I think the confusion lies in the way that the other statutes have been written, frankly. I don't think it's... this can work either way. If it is a grant, we have to have a funding source. If it is a waiver, we're asking the institutions to not charge tuition. You'd have to sort of decide how you want to approach this. If it's the state's policy that the state will deliberately make the investment, then a grant program makes that very clear, which is another way to look at it.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator. And, Chancellor, I think there was another issue that we have an email here from Mr. Bryant that the bill would allow out-of-state veterans to move to Oregon and claim the benefits, and then it also requires residency at the time of application and not when you served. So can, have you seen that email? Can you speak to that?
Chair Walker, yes, I have seen the email, and I perhaps ineloquently, if that's a term, tried to address that in my last...
That's what I thought, with the deceased parent issue.
Comment. With a deceased parent, it's a question. And so do you want to apply our regular residency requirements, or do you... Does the fact that the service member is deceased mean that you'll accept students from anywhere because that was an Oregon service member at the time that she or he enlisted? With regard to the the disabled and the unemployable,
mm-hmm.
I think it's very clear you have to be an Oregon resident, and we would interpret that to mean you have, if the parent has to be an Oregon resident and you're dependent of the parent, then presumably you are already an Oregon resident. That's typically the way that works. But it does raise another question I forgot to ask. I don't know who determines, and it would be good to have it determine, eligibility. Is it the Department of Veterans Affairs? And that's particularly true when you get into unemployability, which is not defined in the statute. So somebody needs to make that call, because I don't think our financial aid officers are probably the right people to do that.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. These are all good questions. Mr. Johnson, do you want to go next?
Good afternoon, Senator Walker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dennis Johnson with the Student Assistance Commission, and I wish I had clear answers to provide you on this. Of the close to 400 programs that we administer, there are several that have parallels that you may use to guide you, perhaps. One of them, unfortunately, obfuscates a little bit on terminology. It's the Oregon National Guard State Tuition Program. About 75% of these funds are federal, and the other remaining balance comes from state sources. And it refers in our Oregon administrative rules, they go back many years, it refers to the program as a waiver program. Well, of course, as Chancellor Pernsteiner pointed out, we can't really waive tuition. That is what happens on the campus. If tuition is waived, it has to be charged to an account, and there is a tracking or an accounting of that cost on the campus. But what we have here is clearly an example of a program that is referred to as a waiver and yet is functioning as a grant that we administer. Another program that we administered last biennium, a small parallel here, is the Oregon Troops to Teachers program. We had a small, relatively small, $165,000 appropriation for the biennium. It was available to veterans who plan to go into education careers at public universities here in the state, basically. And we spent during that time about half the appropriation. The appropriation went away, and it's not funded for the current biennium. But that's an example of a targeted kind of program, certainly that was intended to assist veterans. The best parallel I can come up with is what Chancellor Pernsteiner mentioned already, the Deceased or Disabled Public Safety Officer Grant Program. Now, the reason it's such a parallel is that the maximum grant is the tuition, current tuition at the University of Oregon. Now, that's close to the tuition at the rest of the OUS campuses. Not necessarily tuition and mandatory fees, but it's a fairly standard amount no matter what campus the student would choose to attend. The parallel there is that it is the affected officer. It is also the dependent of the affected officer who is awarded. Now, the benefit of something like this, and this is just my unsolicited advice, if you want to track the cost of something, you know, we can tell you every year, every biennium, what this costs. These funds come out of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Fund. When you have a fund that in the current year we'll be spending $33-34 million on opportunity grants, we're more than doubling that in the next academic year to $72 million. A few hundred thousand sounds, nominal. But, if this kind of program were added into that. Now you're talking substantial diversion of funds from what we plan to do with that new shared responsibility model. Few hundred thousand within the margin of error, perhaps. But if you get into double that amount, or you know, approaching $1 million, that should be perhaps you know, a conscious decision. So the definitional issues, which unfortunately aren't answered in this draft, a waiver versus grant, and then a funding source. I echo what Chancellor Prensteiner was saying. The only other point that surprised me was that it does refer to Oregon-based, generally accredited, not-for-profit institutions. I don't know how there could be a mandate for non-state-supported institutions to waive tuition. Now, certainly, all of the other issues that the Chancellor raised are issues that we address at the Commission with our various programs, whether they're undergraduate, graduate, residency questions. All of those things can be addressed on a standard statewide policy basis. But mandating something without funding it may be the crux of the issue here, and I think there's someone else here to speak to that as well.
Okay. Well, it's sounding like this is screaming out for work group, work group, work group. And I, the newest member on this committee, is going to get this work group, so I hope you're taking notes, Senator Haas, since Mr. Thornhill is your constituent. But let me just say from the outset, this bill, this underlying bill that we have that we're trying to attach to, has got to go. We need the underlying bill. I really want to see if we can work this problem and get it fixed. Please know we only have a very short time frame. In fact, all bills have to be out of this committee by Tuesday of next week. So that's where we are. So, Mr. Wyckoff, I'm just going to give you a few minutes to talk because we're getting behind schedule now, and we're not going to solve this today. But if you can just at least state succinctly your points on the record, then we know where to send Senator Haas into the morass.
I believe I can. Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff, Legislative Director for the Oregon Community College Association. This is not a new issue for us. This is something that, in some form, most of our colleges are already doing. Before the 2007 legislative session, the governor's office had actually asked us to begin to implement tuition waivers for dependents and spouses of those of soldiers killed in action from the time of September 11, 2001. Most of our campuses have done so. The remaining are in a process of doing so. Mm-hmm. It did not include, because we were just not asked to do so at the time, to also include those who were totally disabled or unable to work. That's something that we would be happy to look at, and well, we would, I think, be happy to implement that as well. Providing services for veterans and educational access for veterans is something that's critical to us. It's something that's very important to our core mission. It's something that we do. I think, you know, that is just terribly important to us. We do have a concern about the way that this is worded, and that it. A state-mandated tuition waiver for the community college system steps away from the long-standing approach of allowing local boards to have control over tuition policy, and that's a process that the legislature has respected, and we would hope to see that continue to be respected. It's something, as I said, we would be happy to work with our colleges to do, and I'm sure our colleges would be happy to do so. We're a little concerned as well that for some of our colleges, the whole point of having locally controlled tuition for community colleges or local control of community colleges is that we're able to tailor this to our own campuses. One of our campuses, for example, is doing this through a scholarship program. Most of the rest are doing it through tuition waivers. A lot of our campuses also go further than this. We do a lot of things for veterans. Some of our campuses offer the first 6 credits free to all veterans, not just folks involved in the global war on terror, not just folks, not dependents and spouses. So this is something that, like I said, it's really in our core mission. It's something that we believe in, but we are concerned about changing the current understanding of how tuition policy is set, and that's something that I think our local boards would be very concerned about as well. So I think we would be happy to report to you our progress on adding this section Commission are adding this new category in, as we're happy to talk about the progress that we've made with the request that the governor's office made to us. And I mean, I guess I would just say, in that case, statute was not required to get us to do it. It's something that I think we could do and we would hope to do without changing the way that tuition policy is set for community colleges.
Okay. Any member of the committee have some concern they want to express that you want the work group to work on? Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I pointed out to Senator Hass, ORS 348-180, my reading is that it would include the private, not-for-profit institutions of higher education, because it addresses OHSU or the broad term for not-for-profit, which would be inclusive of the private sector.
Okay. Senator Metzger?
Well, yeah, and I would agree with Senator Morris, I think, because that would help determine whether you go through the waiver process or a grant program. I mean, the private colleges, you can do a grant program. We can't require private institutions to do that, so that is an issue I think would have to be how that would work. I think also, Senator Hass, I think another thing that stuck out to me based on the testimony, too, was you know, the limitations, the open-endedness, you know, I mean, someone can't go perpetually to school, you know, and it has to be a degree path, either the, you know, a certain amount of years that this could take place, in addition to whether it's just achieving a degree or post-secondary, there should be some time frame and, you know, that the bill would still be operable for someone. I know, I think I mentioned this committee last year, I had a nephew that went 8 years to Oregon State, and finally his parents wised up that he would be there forever unless they gave him the stick. But I think, you know, kind of would be issues that I think would be important to address.
Okay.
Just to reiterate that I think all those issues are all doable.
Yes.
In a very short period of time, and I'm hoping this won't be delayed because we do those things. My personal one is on unemployable. Now, we all have friends or people we probably know
that title would apply to. I'm just wondering how necessary it is to include if it hangs up or makes it difficult to get through. Mm-hmm. Unemployable is a very valuable word.
Okay, Senator Hass, yes.
Just if I might add, I would like to speak to the wisdom of including graduate education in this.
Mm-hmm.
More and more professions and jobs and opportunities that are created by that graduate degree, I think, come into play for these folks. And I would suggest, Senator Hass, that be considered in the task force that you work on.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just for the record at this point, the bill as it stands with the ones and threes are fine.
Mm-hmm.
We have no issues there.
No, in fact, we could go ahead, if you want, we could adopt the ones and the threes today or just wait.
Well, no, we can wait. That's fine. But so really the four/two is the only issue still pending. Okay.
That's exactly right. Okay. So, as I indicated, the underlying bill, gentlemen, we need it. So I'm going to give Senator Hass an opportunity to try to work some magic here. If we can't get it done in this short period of time, we can work on it and bring it back in 09. So I want you to know I'm committed to doing that. But we're going to see what we can get done, and we're going to work at breakneck speed, and I have complete confidence that Senator Hass is going to give it his best, and we've got the able Ms. Richardson here to help him, and I will be here as well. But my schedule is such that I can't take the lead, so we're going to let the Senator do that. Gentlemen, thank you. I suspect you'll be called into a work group, so please make yourselves available at a moment's notice. Thank you very much.
Would you like to carry this over?
Do we have to state? Let's carry it over to Tuesday then, which is our last day. So we have to state for the record when we're going to hear this again. So we've got till next Tuesday. Okay. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1066. Thank everyone for attending. running a little bit behind.
Bring it over to what date?
Tuesday of next week, so you've got to have it ready to go.
Let's make a break day.
I guess that'd be D-Day.
Yeah, that's D-Day. Okay, so we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1067. Is Mr. Bennett here? Yes, he is. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1067 exempts outdoor light fixtures from the requirement to use only T-type light bulbs and fixtures designed for metal halide or mercury vapor light bulbs. Removes from the exemption outdoor light fixtures in covered areas used by persons for recreational or educational activities. Extends the date of requirement to replace the R-type metal halide or mercury vapor light bulbs with T-type light bulbs to September 1st, 2008. However, it still requires schools to act with reasonable diligence to replace bulbs prior to that date, declares an emergency as ineffective upon passage.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, you've had a couple of hearings on this, including one that went into real detail on it. I hope that if it's all right with you, that you reference that testimony and I would just be here to answer any questions you have on this. I do want to tell you that I've worked with all of the interested parties on this. I think there is no opposition to it. We've resolved how best to implement what is a really good bill and make it as orderly and meaningful as possible. So I'd ask you to please move the bill along.
Okay, great. And we also have a letter here from Senator Devlin, who's not able to attend. Agreeing with the changes as outlined, and we've heard this a couple of times,
right.
So we're pretty convinced about it now. So sorry to have kept you waiting, Mr. Bennett. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Hass is outside. I'd like to move this bill.
Let's move it.
I'll just let him vote when he comes back in. Okay, Senator Cruz?
Let's go and move. Work session would be
helpful. Yeah, that would be helpful. You could grab him and have him. We'll just let him vote. We'll go into a close of public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 1067.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 1067 for the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1067 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, let's call the roll just for fun.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
And Chairman Walker?
Aye. Senate Bill 1067 passes. Who would like to carry it? Oh, yeah, it was my bill. Okay, I'll take it. Yeah, he's busy doing jobs for the caucus. I'll just carry it. We've got to give Senator Hass a bill pretty soon, though. Okay, so we will close a work session on Senate Bill 1067 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1059, or reopen the public hearing. Let's put it that way. Okay, and we know about this bill now. And so, Mr. Bennett, let's hear... I'm not sure how I want to do this. Do you want me to hear from the school districts, or do you want to speak first and sort of lay out the concerns and the issues?
Would you mind if I saw them?
That'd be perfect.
Sort of put into a broader perspective.
Yeah, that's what I'd like. I didn't see Eileen sitting there, and she didn't sign up, I don't think. Or I'm just now getting the list. See, I move so quick. Okay, great. Well, why don't you two lay it out for us, the broader issues, and then we'll... hear from some other folks.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, on Senate Bill 1059, you have heard from Representative Gilliam, I think, regarding the underlying issue that's involved here in terms of the local issue involving Molalla River and Silver Falls.
And Mr. Bennett, I'm just going to interrupt you for a minute because I didn't see the list, but we have Mr. and Mrs. Beyer here, who I think this issue came from. So,
would you like them first?
That's fine.
Yeah, would they like to bring up former Senator Beyer with them? We get the whole Beyer family.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that's going to happen, but I didn't see them, and I'd really like them to lay out the issue
sure.
So we better understand it. So if I could just have you step down for a minute. And Mr. and Mrs. Beyer, you want to come forward? Thank you.
Senator is going to be here as well. But.
Okay. You mean Senator Dyer? Oh, okay. Great. Okay, you just need to state your names for the record, and then the floor is yours.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, we are Stanley and Kathleen Beyer of Moala, Oregon, and residents of the Moala River School District.
Okay.
Basically, we are here today because we have lost faith in our local school board in dealing with the issue of the transfers and equal transfers. And so we believe that this issue should be dealt with at the state level because we are dealing with state school funding that is held in Salem for our kids, and also believe that discrimination on an individual basis does occur at the local level, which can be addressed if the state takes care of this issue. It helps eliminate those issues. So I guess we passed our written testimony along, which kind of describes our situation on a more specific level. But in regard to trying to portray our loss of faith in the local school board, we've been before the board three times in a period of 4 months, and in that time, very little to nothing was done on our issue specifically. And so at that time, we chose to pull our kids out of district and start paying tuition to the Silver Falls School District. We made that decision consciously with hopes that the school funding could be dealt with. And the numbers that we know of in the last 10 years, 164 pupils have been released to go to Moala River, whereas Moala River has only sent 22 back. We know as of the 06-07 year, 14 were released to Moala and only one back. And as of this school year, we are aware of in the neighborhood of 17 going to Moala, maybe only two back. And all we're asking for from the school board is, you know, let's be fair and equitable with the state funding dollars. I are led to believe that there are dollars reserved in Salem for our kids, and we choose to still go to a public school. The dollars are not going to Silver Falls. The dollars are not going to Moala River. And Moala River is getting extra money for all the extra kids that are coming from Silver Falls. It just seems fair that some money should be able to go back. Also on that issue, Moala River currently holds an agreement between superintendents with the Colton School District, their neighbor on the east side. And that agreement was in place prior to the current superintendents being there, but they've maintained that agreement. So why would they maintain that agreement, an old agreement, and not enter into a new one with Silver Falls District? There seems to be some source of or some sort of discrimination going on there within the district, that families within the district on that side that are close to that Colton border have the choice to move out of district into Colton if the numbers are favorable that way. But on our side, no. So it, you know, we don't have the same options as other patrons in the same district. So also in regard to the school board, we have basically given up on the local Mall River School Board the last time we were there, and some of the last time, the last words we heard from the chair of that school board was, I asked for a reason. Just, you know, why will you not consider this? And she personally said, in a quote, I like my policy. So, so that led me to believe that there was no hope in Malala, you know, changing for the betterment of us so that state dollars could be released for our children. And I just the very little action that Malala was pushing forward just led me to think that this is our last chance here at the state level. And we are paying tuition. We now feel that nothing's going to go anywhere unless it happens here at the state level, and so we feel like we are going to have to move if we want to get into the Silver Falls School District, which the border is only a half mile down the road, three houses down. But, you know, if I move that half mile and move away from the dream house that I built 4 years ago, my kids will get the education that I want them to. We are completely happy with the decision we've made. We don't regret that. We sure would like some support and help with the dollars and the funding, though.
Okay. How many children do you have?
There's three children.
And you're paying tuition on all three?
Yes.
Okay. And they're at Butte Creek?
They're at Butte Creek Elementary.
You know I'm a graduate of Butte Creek.
Yes,
I graduated eighth grade there. Just to let you know.
Okay.
I did not carve my initials anywhere, so you won't be able to find evidence of that. But I still have my yearbook that we made that year. But anyway, Mrs. Beyer, did you want to add anything to that? If you do, you need to state your name for the record.
Kathleen Beyer. We're very happy with what we're doing. Our children are doing great and progressing, and we just feel there's kind of discrimination in this whole situation, and we just would like the fairness of it. You know, I don't understand why some patrons get privileges while others get penalized, just like my husband said, just living half a mile from a border. It's the next closest school and bus stop to us. Other than the other elementary schools in the Malala River School District, which is what our other options have been. And basically, it's really a fairness issue.
Okay, great. Any questions of the committee? Well, I'm really glad you were here to testify. You helped lay out the issue for us, and then I'll go ahead and call up Mr. Bennett and Ms. Flynn, and then they can tell us what the broader issue is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Would you mind local?
So they can go? Sure.
No.
Yeah, because you guys hang out all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, then.
You're closer to it.
Okay. I think I've got three people, Mr. Palmer, Mr. Rossler, and Costar. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You want to start? Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Coster, and I'm the superintendent for the Malala River School District. The Malala River School District is like most other school districts in the state of Oregon. Our school board sees as one of their primary roles that of setting policy. Our school district does have a policy, JECF, inter-district transfer of resident students. It is not unlike many of the school districts that we border. In part, that policy reads, the superintendent may consider for approval requests that meet one or more of the following criteria. One, the student has not met or has exceeded all of the academic content standards, and appropriate additional services or alternative educational options may better be met in another district. Two, the students with unusual disciplinary or emotional problems who would have a greater ability to succeed by a change of district during the school year. And three, students whose parents are moving into or out of the school district during the school year. The school board, at the request of parents, hears inter-district transfer requests that do not meet this criterion. This school year, our school board has undertaken the responsibility to review every policy through a process guided by the Oregon School Boards Association. This process has provided many opportunities for our board members to discuss and debate the various policies that are in place. The policy JECF, Interdistrict Transfer of Resident Students, will be among those that are reviewed. We have gathered policies from other school districts and the Oregon School Boards Association, looking to see if there are other policies that more closely reflect our expectations and beliefs. We expect that our policy review will be complete by the end of the current school year. We would like to have the opportunity to work with Representative Gilliam and others in reviewing the problems that have been raised surrounding this issue. I believe that working together, we can provide a solution that continues to provide flexibility while retaining local control. The Board of Directors is committed to fulfilling its duty to set policy for the Moala River School District, and we will continue to strive to provide every child with the best possible education.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. What's your policy for kids that transfer in from other districts?
Upon reviewing those applications, we make a determination of whether those folks will be successful in our school district, and they're either approved or denied.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. Case by case, or?
Yes, sir.
So, one of your reasons for allowing a transfer out would be somebody who's having discipline issues in a different environment, so you would take somebody from another district with a discipline issue?
We have. Oftentimes the superintendent or principal will call and say, I have a student that needs an opportunity for a fresh start. Here are some of the issues. Would you be willing to accept this student? And oftentimes we will meet with the parents and the student and lay out a contract which says, we will take you. Here are some expectations that we have so that you'll be successful in our school district.
Let's say a parent from a neighboring district says, I would like my kid to come to your school. It's a better curriculum, and they've been released. That's good enough as well?
Those often come with the signature of the superintendent from the other school district, and we review those, and we would probably accept those.
Okay. Do you have any capacity issues at this point? Or
We don't have any capacity issues at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Good questions. Thank you. Yes, I'm sorry. Senator Metzger and then Senator Morris.
One question. The numbers that the buyers provided, are they accurate or close to accurate about the 164 pupils that have transferred to Moala River in the last 10 years and 22 were opted out?
I believe that's appropriate. Silver Falls did provide that information earlier. I don't have it in front of me.
The data itself doesn't mean much until I get to the next question, and that is that because more people want to come to Moala River, one, and very few want to go elsewhere, or there are a substantial number of people that may equal or provide a different look numerically to that issue, but were denied? And I'm kind of curious as to, you have 164 pupils that have transferred, as to, the percentage of those who request to transfer that are accepted, and if you have 22 that came out of Moala River, I mean, how many were actually requested to go out? I mean, if it's 25, then you've accepted a lot of them to go to other districts. If it's 100 and some odd, then it would seem like you're much more restrictive going out than you would be coming in. Can you give me any perspective on that?
So the numbers that were provided were the transfers between two specific school districts, Silver Falls and Moala River. If we look at I have other school districts for which I have many more going out than coming in from some of the other school districts around us. Mm-hmm. Currently this year I have 10 or 12 more students leaving our district than coming to our district in total. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that with Silver Falls, we have more coming from Silver Falls than we've released to Silver Falls this year.
Mm-hmm. I just would be curious to see how many requests you have to go to Silver Falls. In other words, if it looks different, mathematically than the other districts for some reason or not. I think that would be interesting information.
I can provide that for you. I don't have it with me today.
I understand, but that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. with those students that transfer into Molalla from Silver Falls, does the money follow them into your district?
Yes, sir.
So the district that, from which they come releases that money, and you have agreements to that effect. The Colton district, the buyers are feeling that, you know, your policy applies to some and not others. Could you elaborate on the school district, your transfer agreement with the Colton school district?
When I arrived in Molalla and had to approve or deny requests that appeared in that first school year, I was informed that in place was an agreement, a handshake agreement with the Colton School District, that we would allow those transfers back and forth as long as the difference was no more than three. And so I continued with that agreement with the Colton School District. With the other school districts around us, that agreement was not in place. I will tell you that one of the policy, there's a school district close by which we've gathered their policy to review, which does call for a one-to-one transfer between each individual school district that you would have. And that's one of the policies that we are reviewing, which would be very similar to what we currently do with the Colton School District.
So I would gather, Madam Chair, as a follow-up question, mm-hmm. Presently you have an inconsistent policy with respect to your bordering districts.
I guess that would be correct. I'm living with what was in place when I arrived and trying to maintain that policy.
Okay. Just one more, if I could. So, a school district releases a student to another district. The dollars follow the kid. If you don't release a student to another district, but the parents choose to take the kid anyway, a non-release kid, the dollars don't follow the kid, but you don't have them either. Is that correct?
That would be correct.
So
he gets the money.
It stays in the state pool.
It stays in the state pool.
It's divided amongst all the kids in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Ressler, now that you've spoken, you've got to identify.
Right. Well, I guess I'm trying to understand the logic of, you know, I mean, you're going to get, you know, you enrich the pool, but it's really not enough to really count. What would be the benefit of not releasing the kid if, you know, I mean, I can understand if you're going to get the dollars anyway, but you're not going to get the dollars anyway. So it kind of defies logic a little bit, I guess.
I guess from our standpoint, if I were to go back several years, at one point we had 85 students leaving our district and only about 25 coming in. If you do the simple math, that's quite a bit of money leaving our school district that can have an impact on our programs. And I think we've been struggling for the last couple of years. We've reviewed this policy several times to try and find where's an appropriate balance. And this year the issue arose again, and we are reviewing that policy, trying to make an effort at the local level to find a policy that we feel that our board feels comfortable with.
Yeah, I remember one time when I moved to Salem. We stayed in Salem, I think, 2 months. And I lived across the street. If I had lived on the other side of the street, I could have gone to the school that was two or three blocks away. But I lived on this side of the street. There was no bus service, and I had to walk 2 miles to school. I was not a happy camper. So sometimes those inter-district, and when we asked to go to the other school, we couldn't. So sometimes I see why people get upset about that, because I didn't go to school very much. I skipped a lot of school.
You made up for it later on.
I made up for it later on. Yeah, we ended up moving back to Reedsport, but I know what they're talking about, and they're wanting a neighborhood school, one that's a half mile from their house instead of farther. But anyway, I'll leave my comments on the table at the moment. Mr. Rossler, do you want to speak?
Certainly, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Rossler. I'm superintendent of Silver Falls School District in Silverton, Oregon. And while I'm speaking in opposition to the bill today, it's
I'm not unsympathetic to the buyer's case. In fact, I'm very sympathetic to their case. And I do think, from my perspective, it is unfair what's happening to them. And it needs to be resolved at the local level. If it can't be resolved at the local level, if the bill isn't passed during this special session, I imagine we'll be seeing you in 2009. So I really think it's important that we are able to work this out at the local level. Just a quick background, Silver Falls School District, and this goes back into the early 1980s in Marion County. There's been open enrollment between all the school districts in Marion County for many, many years. Some exceptions, and the most recent exception was the Jervis School District, which was losing students to Silver Falls, to Salem, to Woodburn, Mount Angel. And they were losing a large number of students, and they shut their transfer policy down and held on to their students and put in place a system that I think was fair for their district. And it was a one-to-one transfer ratio. So if one student transferred in from Silver Falls School District, they would allow one student to transfer out from the Jervis School District. I think, given what was happening to their district, that was probably a fairly reasonable thing. In the case of Mooloolah River and Silver Falls School District, were primarily a Marion County school district, but the Butte Creek area that's in question here is in Clackamas County. And prior to mandated unification, that portion of the now Silver Falls School District, it was an independent K-8 school district in two counties. When mandated unification came along, it decided to join the Silver Falls School District rather than the Mooloolah River School District. But there are a lot of people in the Clackamas portion of that old district that their allegiance was to Mooloolah. They shopped there, they went to high school there, their church is there, et cetera. So we carried over our practice in Marion County, and basically we said anybody in the Silver Falls School District that attends Butte Creek School, if they want to, or lives in the Butte Creek attendance area, if they want to attend Mooloolah School, we'll allow them to go. And we've never denied any student who wants to leave our district and go to any district in the state of Oregon. That's been our practice. In some cases, it's easier for us to say that because we happen to border the second largest school district in the state of Oregon, Salem, which is overflowing with kids, and we get youngsters that come our direction for a variety of reasons into Silver Falls School District. But this is really about, in my opinion, Mooloolah River and the Silver Falls School District and what's happening. And it is, in my opinion, an unfair balance. I mean, we have a significant larger number of kids leaving our district and going to Mooloolah. We have no problem with that. We believe there are a few families that would like to come our direction, and we think they should be able to come our direction. And it's unfair to those families, and we believe it's also unfair to our school district. And I'm not interested in the dollars. I'm not interested in the buyer's tuition dollars. I'm interested in trying to treat these families who, for whatever reason, want to leave their district and go to another. And those who leave our district have a lot of reasons. One, they work in the Mooloolah area, or they work up towards Oregon City. Their child care is there. Their churches are there. Their physicians are there. Their grandparents are there. I mean, it goes on and on. And I really don't care what the reason is. If that's where they want to go, then we'll release them. And we're not asking for a one-to-one. I mean, if we're sending 75 or 40 kids, whatever the number is, to Mooloolah, we're not asking for 40 kids back. But if there are 10 that want to come back, we think they should be able to come back. And we'd like to try to work that out with our local school district before there's a law put in place requiring that, because I think there's some unintended consequences of a law like that when you try to apply it statewide.
How long has this been going on, though, with the buyers? Is this a recent development? Or
no, since 97, since we unified in 97.
Yeah, so yeah. We're at 2008. That's 11 years that this hasn't been resolved. We had the Canyonville South Umpqua School District issue, and that's been going for 80 years. So we really don't want to have this go on for 80. We'd like to help you get it resolved. Let me ask you this question, because you're not the only district that this has happened to. I got an email from a woman, and she lives outside of Lake Oswego. She's outside of the Lake Oswego district, and they wanted to transfer in.
And, oh, she's actually a resident of the Lake Oswego School District. And she's upset with the fact that school districts are allowed to charge tuition to students who have not been released from their school district. She says that Lake Oswego charges tuition to students transferring from other districts that have not received their release. And when questioned about that, in addition, Lake Oswego charges more tuition for those students who are special needs. So, and the superintendent of Lake Oswego School District said that district does not want to have to pay the extra cost for, quote, salvage projects. I find that patently illegal. So answer me this. When you transfer students in and out, do you charge extra tuition for students who are special needs children?
Well, it's not tuition. When we have a transfer agreement, let's say between, let's pick Mount Angel School District in Silver Falls, and it's a special needs student. Mm-hmm. First of all, the basic funding follows that student who transfers out.
Right.
And then there's some additional funding that comes because they're a special needs student. And that money also would be either transferred out or there'd be an agreement between the two districts. It would follow the student.
But if they have to pay tuition, though, because they don't get released,
okay,
then what happens?
Well,
it's like the buyers. The buyers are paying tuition because
right.
they're not released. So if they had a special needs child, any one of their three or all three were special needs, would they be paying more tuition?
No, probably not. We've never had that circumstances. In fact, we charge less than we receive from the state for tuition right now. But I can understand. I mean, if you're talking about a youngster who costs $40,000 a year and you're receiving no funding from the state, and the district next door hasn't released them, so you're receiving nothing from the state, then you have then push the responsibility of educating that high-cost student onto your local taxpayers. And that dilutes the amount of money available for your own kids, special needs and regular ed kids.
I understand that, yeah. But, yeah. You know, it's an issue, and I think it needs to be addressed. So we've got about 5 more minutes of this committee. We have more people to testify. So I think you were about done.
Yes, I am.
Mr. Palmer, you're the principal of Butte Creek Elementary. Why does everybody want to come to Butte Creek?
Well, it's a great school.
That's right. That was your softball of the day.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's a good way to start. Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Palmer, and I am the principal at Butte Creek in my third year out there. And I would like to tell you that in that role, I get to see firsthand the impact of how these policies and practices play out on families, including the buyers. I'd also like to update you on the numbers that Stan and Kathleen gave you, 164-22. I had provided them with those numbers a little bit earlier in this school year while we were still working on the current year, 07-08, and the actual numbers are 182-25, just so we have that accurate. And that does go back to 96-97. Over the past 3 years, we've seen students have to leave Butte Creek because transfers were not approved midstream for students who have begun their schooling years at Butte Creek and had to leave because they've moved into the Mall River School District, and families like the buyers who would like to come to Butte Creek who are not allowed to do so. And Senator Cruz, I believe you've hit the nail on the head when you talk about the logic behind the situation. Right now, there is no benefit to the buyer family not being released to come to our district and have the funds follow them. And that I am very concerned about as they write a check for $750 every month to our school district, and we'll do so through the end of the year. And my concern as an advocate for this family is that we be able to get them into a situation sooner rather than later and get this resolved. And I agree with Mr. Rossler that it would be wonderful if we could get this resolved between the school districts. My interest is sooner than later as this drags on. And I believe you asked Mr. Rossler how far this went back with the buyer family. And as far as my knowledge, it goes back to about this time last year when they were first applying to be able to come to Butte Creek. And so we're about a year in, and not very much closer, in my opinion.
Okay. Any further questions? Yes, Senator Metzger.
Well, just a gut feeling on this. I mean, as we talk about this policy, and we'll hear again from Mr. Bennett briefly about other consequences, you know, all these issues that we get, and Chairman Walker was talking about another one we were dealing with, always come from with an impetus. You know, in this case, it may be the buyers who have a situation that illustrates a larger problem. And so we often do two things in the legislation. You know, it brings the larger problem into focus, and we try to resolve that if we see that it's a legislative issue, or try to encourage others to resolve the issue, you know, with the threat that we'll go ahead and do the legislation, you know, if you can't work this out. We've done a lot of that with OSAA and other issues, and sometimes you can find out that reasonable people can solve issues so that you don't have to have the very rough edge of the legislature. You know, my own, just in hearing the story today, that I feel would be, number one is, I think probably the best interest of everybody to immediately resolve the buyer situation might be a really good idea. And then we can look at the broader issues of how we go forward. But I just think that that would be in everybody's best interest because, you know, for all the maybe other details that we're not hearing, it would seem to indicate that that might be a helpful first step.
All right. Thank you, Senator Metzger. Gentlemen, I thank you, and you may put this back in your lap to work it out. And as Senator Metzger said, we did that last session with a number of things, and I was very pleased. The State Board, the Board of Higher Education, University System, they all worked out the resource fee issue, and so students have transparency in the fees that they're paying when they sign up to go to college. And you know, we didn't have to solve that legislatively, but we had the big hammer, and that brought them to the table. So,
and we had more time.
And we had a little more time.
Yes.
So we'll see how this goes, but I want to hear from the other folks here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your trip out. Morgan, I want you to come up with Chuck and Eileen, and I want to finish in no more than 10 minutes here because I'm starting to fade.
Yeah, I have a committee coming up.
And you have it. When's your? Do you have another committee?
Yeah.
I thought they quit at 5:30.
We have a busy transportation meeting tonight.
Oh yes. Okay. All right. Well, Senator Metzger has committee at 6, and he needs to eat. So
we'll be brief.
Okay. Great. So, Mr. Bennett, start.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck Bennett, representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, just couldn't agree more than with Senator Metzger on his previous comments regarding the real need to resolve the buyer's problem, and for Molalla River to go through the process of reviewing its policies regarding these transfers. Certainly, Superintendent Rossler describes, I think, the kind of real humanity that goes into this. I think also Superintendent Koster trying to deal with individual issues. But I think it's important to stress these individual cases, district by district, that do occur, and they do occur. I don't think we're seeing the tip of an iceberg. I think we're seeing an ongoing issue in Butte Creek. I can recall this issue coming up many sessions ago. Representative Larry Soa had a relative out in Butte Creek, and it really had a lot to do with this consolidation of districts, where kids went during all that. Butte Creek has been a bit of a flashpoint over the years on this issue, and hopefully this gets resolved, and I'm hoping through the good offices of Representative Gilliam, and I assure you that we will participate in this as well, assisting on this issue. We don't want to see this come to the legislature. This is not the kind of issue we believe is best resolved with a statewide, one-size-fits-all resolution, and certainly not one that does a one-for-one. That just is not the right way to resolve this. It is, I still think, relying on local school districts, certainly serving your role as a sounding board for the public to keep us all informed of this. This problem didn't come to us with asking us to come help these districts resolve this. And as soon as we hear about these problems, we really try to play a role in this. And I think the unintended, and I just hate using it, but there's just, it was hard because this bill came quickly to even begin to pull together the level of consequences we'd see statewide. I checked on one of your districts, Madam Chair, just by accident. My boss, Ken Hunsaker, happened to be here, and I asked Ken if he'd run into this before. He said, yeah, when he arrived at Bethel, 450 students had signed up to leave. A huge number of students for that district. By the time it was over for him, and he retired and moved on, all students who wanted, the 450 had dissipated. They had taken a look at it and said, geez, we're doing something wrong for the consumers of our school district here in that they want to leave in these numbers. And they were allowing any student who wanted to transfer to transfer. And most districts tend to operate that way because there are really legitimate reasons for inter-districts transfers, and most districts are operating as liberally as possible in that way without having 450 kids walk out of your school district and destabilize your entire program. And I asked Eileen Flynn from Portland Public Schools to join me because Portland has a really interesting situation with the number of school districts that border it. And if you don't mind, Madam Chair, I'd like to let Eileen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Eileen Flynn. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Portland Public School District. If you look at just the numbers basis, we take in over 600 more students a year than we let out. We really believe it shouldn't be just a numbers game, a quid pro quo, because a lot of factors go into play when determining whether or not to accept a student or let a student go for transfer. Family situation, proximity to services. We have a number of students from Skapoo School District who come into our school district because their parents work in Portland Public School District, and they don't want to have that large commute back and forth to be with their children. So their children come in with them on their way to work this morning. They pick their children up after work, or we offer the after-school services. So it's a family situation. We had another situation just this week where we had a special needs student who was being harassed and stalked by an irreputable person. My testimony refers to him as a pimp. So we worked with that student's family, and the student also had family members in another school district to arrange for a transfer to another school district. We get a lot of students who come into our district from David Douglas, from Reynolds. Those are districts that are growing and have capacity issues. We obviously, as a declining district, don't have the same capacity issues and can take in more students than the surrounding districts around us can take from our own. But we always want to look at what's in the best educational interest of that student and make sure that a student who wants to go out is doing so for the right reasons, for academic reasons, for family reasons, for medical services reasons. We had a student who was a hemophiliac, and we released them to go to a district that was closer to their transfusion center. So it's a system that just looks at if we get five from one school district and we have five or six that want from our district that want to go into that district, you know, do we just let them out based on the numbers? You could have a family that wants to send three students to District X, but we've already only taken in two students from them. So do we tell the parents only two of your kids can go to that school? So those are sort of unintended consequences that we feel we really need to look at the picture broadly. And if there is a statewide problem with inter-district transfers, and I know the Lake Oswego incident with them actively recruiting students because they are a declining district and charging tuitions, that's a whole separate issue, but it's related in some way because you're dealing with students going across district lines. So why not step back, resolve the buyer's situation because it does need to be resolved, but is there a real problem in the state? And what's the best way to find the right balance that serves all school districts? Because every school district is different. And the urban areas, Salem, Portland, Beaverton's a growing school district. David Douglas is a growing school district. How can we find a solution that works best for all of us and not harming another? For us to lose 600 students, it would be disastrous.
So this bill, in other words, would be like shooting a cannon instead of taking a fly swatter to the problem.
I believe so, and we're starting to stabilize our student enrollment, and we don't want to lose those gains that we're making.
Okay. Morgan.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Morgan Allen for the Department of Education, and our CRAC Legal Affairs Coordinator, Cindy Hunt, quickly put together this one-pager I handed out to you that I think lays out the four primary methods of how students transfer within district and how state school fund flows and responsibility for residency. So I'll let you take a look at that and answer the question. A couple of things I'd just like to raise the point. Senator Walker did mention a complaint from a student or from a parent in Lake Oswego, and we have the Department of Education has received a formal complaint from a discrimination appeal from a parent in Lake Oswego regarding the apparent practice of the Lake Oswego School District charging more tuition for special needs students. And the complainant's rights, we believe, are covered under ORS 659-850, which is discrimination prohibited in OAR 581-021-0049, which is the hearings and appeals process. I can't comment directly on that because that is still a pending process, but I can speak generally. The chair asked me a few questions, and I hope I can comment on those just generally since it is a pending complaint case. Mm-hmm. There are essentially, if you look at the sheet that Cindy prepared for you, the very last thing, paying tuition to attend schools. Under the provisions in ORS 339-115, school districts can invite non-resident students to attend their district and pay tuition. So several school districts across Oregon do that practice, Lake Oswego being the one cited most often in these hearings. But I think generally it would be the department's opinion that protected classes such as race, religion, disabilities would not be grounds for charging a differential tuition rate, that is, charging more if you're an African-American student or charging more if you're a student with disabilities. So as that case goes, makes its way through the process, I'd be happy to update the committee on that. And one other thing I would like to point out, if the committee does decide to move forward with this bill, I believe it may want to take a look at amending the actual interdistrict transfer statute. This bill amends the non-resident pupil contract statute, not the interdistrict transfer statute.
Okay. This is a mess. Thank you for your testimony. And I'm not going to move this bill. I can't. There's too much going on. There are too many issues that have been raised. I do want to keep in touch with you about this case in Lake Oswego. But I'm going to let the folks try to figure this one out on their own. And we've got 2009. Are you okay with that?
Madam Chair, I do think this probably requires more work.
A lot more work.
Than we may have time for. It would be a comfort, I would think, to know if there's a resolution to the Molala thing before we leave in February, or at least a date certain for when we can know what the resolution will be.
What I can do is hold this bill over till Tuesday.
We can do that.
Let me do that. I'm going to hold this bill over because I need to be somewhere. Senator Morse wants to talk. Senator Metzger has committee. I'm going to hold this bill over till Tuesday. Senator Morse?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly. An arithmetic solution is not a solution to this issue.
Yeah.
But I believe there are some broad policy issues that are worthy of discussion. There should be no discrimination in inter-district agreements, where you have one agreement that's different than another agreement with the same district and surrounding districts. And the number one issue is, what's in the best interest of the child?
Mm-hmm.
That has to be weighed in light of the district's own self-interest, which is money.
Yeah.
I agree, and that's, I need to cogitate this one. I understand, Ms. Flynn, what you're talking about the numbers, but 182 to 25 is pretty disparate. And, you know, I think this committee wants to think about the testimony we've heard today, so I am going to hold this over till Tuesday.
Senator Walker, I would be happy to find out from our enrollment and transfer persons how many people we actually get, students we get requests from.
Okay.
Because Portland Public Schools, we offer a lot of different choices and programs within our district. So we may get a lot more requests to come in than we do to go out. So it would probably be helpful for the committee to have that information, and I will see what I can find out on that, too.
Thank you. We're going to adjourn.